honest that I'm an alcoholic. Hello, Santa Maria. I'm very glad to be here. There's familiar faces. My sponsor's here. I thought she was in Malibu, and she just showed up with her daughter. That's awesome. So she'll keep me really honest. Let me think. So, you know, it's not easy for me to do this, to get up in front of people and share like this. It's not in my comfort zone. And the thing that makes it work is that I know that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we love each other no matter what. There isn't really any judgment, and we do love each other. And that gives me a feeling of great safety. Actually, I texted with Tina today and told her what I was doing, and she said, remember to be a hollow bone. And that's an interesting thing to think about, and just to let whatever comes through come through. And so I prayed a lot today. I wrote 11 pages of notes, which has got to be ridiculous. I'm an old school teacher, and I never went to class unprepared, and so I can't even do this without some sort of a preparation. You know, I tried to be in the Poetic Justice Project at one point, and I couldn't do it. The anxiety was so much for me that I couldn't do it. I had to drop out of it, and I didn't have a very big role. You know, so it's just the way that I'm built is that I've been dealing with anxiety, you know, for a lot of my life. And I can remember the first time that I had to speak, quote unquote, publicly. I was in ninth grade. I was in Catholic school. It was an all-girls school. And I had to give some sort of athletic report. And I didn't have an athletic bone in my body. And I was given this position, and I got up there, and I was shaking so badly that I couldn't do it. And I don't think I cried because I'd been taught not to cry, but I was definitely paralyzed. And the nun took me out of the room and yelled at me and told me that that there was something deeply wrong with me, that I couldn't do this simple thing. And that was when I was like 13, you know, that I couldn't do this speaking. So I found a solution for that, and the solution was in my basement at my house where my parents had a full bar, and I could go down into the basement and help myself to alcohol, a drink, a little drink, not a big drink, just a little drink, and that really helped with anxiety. And so I did that a lot. And starting before ninth grade, I was doing that. I was going down to the basement and helping myself to some alcohol. And that would calm me down, and I could function and get through whatever else was going on in my life. Anxiety and depression sort of littered my path through life. And I've been sober a long time. I got sober in January of 1981. I know that's longer than some of you have been alive. And the deal is that it's only through the love and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can stand up here tonight, and that I was willing to say yes to Robert and come here and do this. I believe that I was born an alcoholic. And, you know, I never wanted to do any genetic testing at all, but I was sick a while back, and one of the practitioners wanted to just test for one particular gene. And she did, and she found out that I had two copies of this mutation. And she told me that, and she gave me a list of all the things that were likely to be wrong with a person that has this. And it's not a rare mutation, by the way. Probably everybody in this room has maybe one copy, some two. And the symptoms of that mutation are addiction, anxiety, depression. Those are the symptoms. And so, you know, some of us just come in with this genetic predisposition to alcoholism, drug addiction. In order to get through life, we find that that's what worked the best was to use and drink. And that gave me the courage that I didn't have on my own to get through life. So I do think I was born an alcoholic, but I love being sober, and I love having tools to deal with who I am. And among those tools, of course, are the steps, and particularly the sixth and seventh step. It took me a long time to really appreciate those two steps. I just thought they were something I just thought about and didn't have to do anything about. You know, just become willing and humbly ask. And I realized as time went on that those were two of the most important steps in my arsenal, because I could turn who I am over to my higher power and trust that somehow things were going to be better. And that's been the case. I've had to do those steps a lot in my life. I was born into an alcoholic family with lots of alcoholism, you know, all around. My grandmother, my dad's mother, was an alcoholic. She wasn't an alcoholic until the Depression. That was a long time ago. And what they did to her, the treatment for her, was they would put her in mental institutions and give her electric shock treatments. That was how they treated her alcoholism. And they did that repeatedly to her, and she never quit drinking. I mean, I don't think I ever saw my dad's mother sober, ever. She just sat in a chair and drank all the time. But it was better, because before the electric shock treatment, she used to try to kill my grandfather with a knife. And that was, you know, that's why she ended up being institutionalized, and that's the system that worked. My mom's sister was an alcoholic of the hopeless worst variety, and she was in and out of rehabs all her life, and she died with a wet brain. She didn't know anybody. She was locked in a locked room in an institution. So I kind of knew what alcoholism looked like with women anyway. So my mom was ACA. Both of my grandparents on her side were alcoholic, and she was Al-Anon, but she wasn't treated. She had those diseases, but she didn't have any treatment. And so she was, by nature and by circumstances, always angry, always depressed, always anxious, and always difficult to live with. And I love her, and I loved her in spite of that, but she was really difficult to live with. My dad loved to drink. I mean, he really enjoyed the partying aspects of drinking, and so I saw a lot of that part, too. And some of my earliest memories are of my mom telling, and I was a little kid. I mean, I was like six and under, and I came from a good family, you know. I mean, on the outside, this family looked really good. You know, everybody did the right things. My dad worked, my mom stayed home and took care of the kids, And what people on the outside thought was the most important thing to my parents is how what you thought of us. It didn't matter what we thought of us. It just mattered what you thought of us. And so, you know, that's kind of how it was. And my earliest memories of my mom was she would tell me that I was just like my Aunt Virginia. And this was the sister that she absolutely hated, that ruined every family gathering ever with alcohol and self-pity. Self-pity was good. Self-pity went a long ways in our family. And she just would ruin every gathering. And so my mom would call me by my aunt's nickname, Jin, when I was, good nickname for a drunk, huh? When I was just a little kid. And I don't know if we live up to the expectations of the people in our lives, that the people in our lives have for us, or, you know, if we would have been the way we are anyway, I don't know. But I taught school for a lot of years, and you know, one of the things that I saw with my students was that if I had high expectations of them, they usually lived up to them. And I tried to set that bar pretty high for my kids. I worked at a continuation school, and I loved it. And you know, they let me teach Shakespeare, which, you know, who really needs to know Shakespeare? But you feel really smart when you do know Shakespeare. And, you know, it doesn't hurt to feel smart, right? And so, and it's a great leveler to, because we read everything out loud in class. And so everybody had an opinion about what Shakespeare said, because it was pretty hard stuff, and nobody knew for sure. So everybody's opinion counted, was equally corrupt. And so I don't, you know, I believed that setting that bar was high was a good idea. I was brought up Catholic in the outer city of Detroit. So I didn't grow up in the inner city of Detroit. I had a Detroit address, but I was in the outer city of Detroit. And I went to a Catholic parish school, which is, you know, what was the good thing to do. And we had some really mean nuns that came from Pittsburgh. And they were the mean kind. They weren't very well educated, and they didn't like kids at all. And I was a pretty good student, but I drove some of those nuns nuts because I had developed, you know, I had this anxiety thing going on, and I developed a tic, you know, not the little insect, but like a, yeah. And my tic was I would sit in the chair and rock, and I would just rock and look up and stare out the window. And it drove those nuns crazy. And so they were constantly calling my parents to have them come into the convent, and they wanted them to punish me so that I would behave better in school. And my parents listened to them. They always showed up at the convent. I think they called my pediatrician, but they never, ever talked to me about it because we just didn't talk. In my family, you know, we just didn't talk. And so about seventh or eighth grade, I found alcohol, and I learned to control that movement, you know, that movement that I didn't want, because I really didn't want to be in trouble all the time. And but I continued to use alcohol a lot to block out that anxiety. And so my parents drank a lot. My grandparents drank a lot. My aunts and uncles drank a lot. Everybody drank a lot in my family. And all the kids, we used to have like big family get-togethers at the lake. And so all the kids could see the parents getting drunk, and I was one of those kids, and we started emptying their booze into the lake. That was my Al-Anon at the beginning. It was to just empty their booze into the lake. We did that for a while until we figured out that we could just drink their booze. And that would be, you know, just as good. They wouldn't be drinking it. And so we'd be protecting them. But we would drink it. And we mixed, I don't know, I never had a Long Island tea, or whatever that is, with all the different kinds of alcohol, because I quit drinking before those came in. But I think we invented it, because we would layer these drinks, you know, with a little bit of everything that was in the bar. And we would get really, really drunk and save the parents, save the grandparents. When I was young, my parents would go out, and they would leave my sister and me home by ourselves after we were, you know, a little bit older, seventh grade, eighth grade. And I would often, by myself, go down in the basement and drink enough that I would black out and pass out. And they'd come home and they'd find me laying on the floor, and the linoleum in the basement floor. And again, nobody ever said anything. It was just the way, you know, that we just didn't talk about things. I became two people. I really did become two people. I had this good girl persona, good Catholic girl persona, which still hangs around today some of the time. And then I had the four horsemen, you know, terror, frustration, fear, and bewilderment. And I didn't know about those until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was shocked to read about those and know that that was how I grew up. And it wasn't outside of me. You know, I wish I could say that I turned out the way I did because of something outside, but it was really all in me. I am so sure that I would have been a drunk no matter who raised me, where I was raised. I mean, that's just who I was. And at 15, I ended up in the emergency room because of a suicide attempt. And that, you know, that was a big deal. My parents had to come pick me up. They pumped my stomach.
And I was a little kid. I mean, I'm not a very big adult. I was a really little kid. And they, you know, and they scolded me. The doctors did. The doctors scolded me and the technicians that were working on me. My parents took me home, and I went down the basement, and they never said a word. That was, you know, that was it. I mean, we just didn't talk. And so I don't know. How do you make sense out of that? I didn't know how to make sense out of that. In high school, I went to a big high school, a big girls' high school in Detroit, and I really liked it. There were lots of people I didn't know, new people. I didn't have that tick anymore, so I didn't stand out in class like I used to. I did well. I studied well, and then about 11th or 12th grade, I started hanging out with the girls that went drinking on the weekends, and that's what I did, and I could outdrink all of them, and they still talk about that. When I went back for my 40th and my 50th high school reunion, they reminded me how much I drank. I know, huh? That's a great way to make your mark in the school. And I ended up in trouble. I ended up pregnant at 17 years old with this Catholic family that didn't talk about anything. And here they had this pregnant daughter. It was about 1964. No, it wasn't. It was 66 when I got pregnant, because my son was born in 1967. He was born January 4th, 1967. And so I got pregnant 9 months before that. And I can figure these things out. And so, you know, I'm good at math, I know. And I really wanted to get an abortion. I did not want this baby. The father of the baby was not my boyfriend. I'd had a boyfriend through high school. It wasn't my boyfriend. It was a boy. We traveled from Detroit to Los Angeles to go to Disneyland. I met this guy in Disneyland, and I got pregnant with his kid. I know. I don't know which ride it was on. No, it wasn't on a ride. But he was a Marine. He was a Marine. He was stationed at Camp Pendleton. And he was on his way to Vietnam, and he was an MP. He was trained to be an MP, and he was on his. I still remember his name, Rick Schultz. I remember the town he was born in, York, Pennsylvania. I mean, I remember all of that stuff because it was a big deal. And so I came back to Michigan, and within a short time, I knew I was pregnant. And I don't know that. It was a big deal, and I couldn't. My boyfriend all the way through high school. I tried to make him think it was his kid, but it wasn't his kid, and I knew that. He was willing to marry me. He was willing to pretend that it was his kid, even though I found out later when I made amends to him that he suspected that it wasn't his kid, because he could count too. And so he had a football scholarship to Oklahoma, and I was ready to go to Oklahoma. Miriam was ready to go to Oklahoma, and I just every night I sat in my closet and cried, because I couldn't do that to him. I couldn't lie to him and marry him when it wasn't his kid, and so he went to Oklahoma. I went to a home for unwed mothers. This is where I ended up, a Catholic home course for unwed mothers. And funny thing about that was you couldn't drink there, which was a good thing. And it was all women, which was a good thing. And everybody was nice to me. You know, we were all in the same place. We were all pregnant. And I probably that was the happiest time in my life up until that point, was living in that home for unwed mothers. It was the first time that I felt kind of at ease and comfortable and like I fit in. So I went into labor, and the baby was born. It was a little boy.
And I named him Gerard Joseph. Gerard after, I was a good Catholic. Gerard after the patron saint of mothers. And Joseph after, you know, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. And so I had this kid, and I left him in the hospital because I put him up for adoption. Because I couldn't raise him by myself, and I did not want my parents to raise a kid the way that they raised me. Not that they were bad, awful parents. But I was so miserable, and I couldn't see myself in raising this kid. And I didn't have any money, I didn't have anything. You know, what was I going to do? I had to lean on my parents, and I didn't do it. And so that was a huge decision. And I drank a long time at that decision afterwards. That was like the perfect excuse to drink, is that I'd given this kid up for adoption. And it gave me, I got a lot of mileage out of that in the drinking world. And right after he was born January 4th, 1967, I started going to the biggest university that we had that I could commute to, and that was Wayne State University in downtown Detroit. And I got to take the bus down there, and I got to walk over drunks to get to the campus. So there was lots of reminders of what alcohol would do to me, would do to anybody that drank enough of it. And right at the, this is another reason I have such a difficult time with giving, talking, is that one of the first classes I took was a required speech class. And I had just gotten out of, you know, just really gotten out of the hospital. And so it was a personal experience speech. So I used that for my personal experience, which is really not a wise thing to do. And this one kid followed me out of the classroom and told me how scummy he thought I was for having given this baby up for adoption. And I can still remember the disdain in his voice, and I can see his face. He was, you know, some white kid with short hair, and just in my face about what I did. And today I was telling Janet the story, and she said, well, maybe he was adopted, and he was angry that he was adopted. You know, I mean, yeah, it could be, who knows. But anyway, I left Wayne State after that, and I transferred to Oakland University, which was just a tiny college in Michigan outside of Detroit. And my parents moved to that same area. They left the neighborhood they lived in while I was growing up because there was so much shame around what had happened. Because, you know, rumors get around and people find out, and good God, you know, and if the most important thing in your world is what the neighbors think, this was not a good thing. And so they told everybody that I had mononucleosis because that was the big disease at the time. And so I couldn't come down for Christmas because I was too sick. I had to stay up in my room, and we had to keep the shades pulled all the time. And you know, there was a lot of shame. And so I left Wayne State, and I transferred to Oakland University, where the first thing that I did was smoke pot. That was the very first thing I did, because this was 1967, and I had really thought all the way through high school that pot was like heroin. You shot it with a needle, and it was really addicting. But I was really curious about what pot was, and so I started smoking pot when I got to college. And I lived at home with my parents because I felt as if they had spent way too much money on me already, sending me to that home for unwed mothers. And I didn't want them to have to spend any more money on me. And so I moved in with them, which was just more of the same. And I got a job at Ford Motor Company and the trim plant in Shelby Township. And so I went to college during the day. My classes started usually early in the morning. And then I worked the afternoon shift from 3 until like 11:30. And it was a great job. I worked in the factory, but I was in a little tiny office where I was in charge of a CB radio to get materials to the different departments. And the general foreman took a liking to me.
Yeah. And so that meant that at lunch, he would take me out for lunch, and we would go to the local bowling alley. Bowling is big in Michigan. And we'd have drinks, you know, and then we'd sit in the car and make out. And this guy was married, he had a family, you know, but I was, you know, a scumbag, huh? Me, not him so much, but me, for being involved in that. But I thought I was controlling and managing my drinking. I thought that I was doing pretty well because I wasn't drunk all the time. And I decided in my last year in college, I met a guy that wanted to marry me, and I did. And I married him so that I could get out of my parents' house. Because my mother was an unrecovered Al-Anon ACA person, and she had said to me that if I ever leave that house without being married, I could never come back. And I believed her. I believed her. Can you imagine that I would believe that? But I did. And so I got married, and I still drank, but I studied. I studied hard, and I graduated from college. And when it came time to get my diploma, I didn't want to do that. I didn't get the gown and the robes and all that crap and walk across the stage. None of that meant anything to me. I didn't feel like I was worth any of that. I just wanted to be under the radar. Got my diploma, kept on working at Ford Motor Company, and then I was put in a position of where I could continue to work at Ford Motor Company in personnel, or I could be a teacher, I could go into teaching. And so I decided to go into teaching, which was, you know, probably that was the decision I made. And so I got a job at a local high school, and the drinking age in Michigan at that time was 18. And so you can see that. And the teachers really like to drink. I mean, I think all professions do, but they really like to drink. On Friday night, the teachers would all meet at the local neighborhood bar and get drunk. And I was right there with them, and I got really, really drunk right there with them. And also, my students were right there with us. So it wasn't a real good situation at all. And my husband eventually left. You know, because the rest of the week when I wasn't drinking at the bar, the one time a week I drank at the bar with the teachers, I was home correcting papers, drinking wine. I mean, that's what I did as I drank. And so I think I wanted the separation because by the time we got married, I knew I didn't love him. And it was a big mistake walking down that aisle, but my parents had already paid for all the hoopla about the wedding, so I married him anyway, and we separated, and I knew in my heart that I was an alcoholic, because I'd seen lots of alcoholics in my life, but in my life, the way that, you know, if you were an alcoholic, if you were the one that was drinking, my mother was the one that was judging, and you were bad, you know, there was no idea of a disease concept or any of that kind of stuff. Alcoholics were bad people. And so that's exactly what I thought I was a bad person. And I thought, someday I'll get good and I'll quit drinking. You know, someday I'll get good enough to be good and I'll quit drinking. And I think that I drank too long to be able to do that on my own. You know, I had drunk too long and I couldn't get good. I couldn't quit drinking. So I quit my job and I moved to Santa Cruz. And I left everything that I had a house where I was living in Michigan because, you know, I don't know why I had a house, but I did. So I sold the house. I packed a U-Haul trailer, a very small U-Haul trailer, and drove across the country. I stopped in Colorado and visited my sister, who was at the first Buddhist university. It was Naropa in Boulder, Colorado. So I was there at the very beginning of that. And I was, you know, drinking my way through that. And there were a lot of people drinking and drugging their way through that. I wasn't the only one. But and then I headed to Santa Cruz from there. And good time to be in Santa Cruz. 1974, single, had a lot of money because I sold this house. I mean, I didn't have a ton of money, but it seemed like a ton of money to me. And And there I was in Santa Cruz. And I drove up to this friend of a friend's house with my U-Haul trailer. And it was early in the morning, bright, sunny morning, early. Knocked on the door. She came downstairs. She had been asleep upstairs. And we went into the kitchen, and she told me, she gave me a drink. She gave me tequila and grapefruit, which made, I mean, I liked that right away. And I liked Santa Cruz right away. And she told me if I messed with her boyfriend, she'd stab me. So I pretty much had it. I got that she was clear. She was really clear. And so that's when, you know, life got more interesting when I was in Santa Cruz, because there was nobody watching me. I didn't have to behave for anyone. My parents weren't there. Nobody was there, you know. I didn't know anybody. I got a job. This gal lived 6 houses from the beach off on Westcliff in Santa Cruz. I mean, it was, like, fabulous. And I had money. I really didn't have to work, but I didn't want to spend all my money because I'm a thrifty sort. So I got a job at some herb company, and it wasn't marijuana herb. It was golden seal and ginseng, if some of you might remember that stuff from the old days. And I was putting it in capsules by hand. That was my job, putting that in capsules. And I did that job for a while, and then I moved to I had the good fortune to find a tool shed that I could rent for $75 a month. I know, sounds bizarre, but these young girls lived in this house, and they were really young. I mean, I was 26, I was old, and they were young, and this was their first time out in the world, and so they had this really cute little house, and they needed more money, so they rented their tool shed, and I had bathroom and kitchen privileges in the tool shed. And so, from the tool shed. So I was really happy. I could walk to Taco Bell. I could walk to the liquor store. I could walk to the beach. I could walk to my job. And I didn't wear shoes for any of it. I had the most calloused feet in Santa Cruz. And that lasted for a while. They threw a lot of parties. They were real pretty young party girls, and they threw a lot of parties. And I found out that I blacked out at every single party, because they would ask me the next day, who was that guy? What guy? I mean, I don't remember anything. You know, I did not remember anything. And so I had to start figuring out what I'd done, because I didn't remember anything. I stayed there for a while, and then I started moving around. I moved up to Ben Lomond, which is up in the hills, in the mountains, they call them, in Santa Cruz. I moved up there, and I got a job at a bar. And I was never a bar person. I didn't have a personality for bars at all. And so when people said they'd buy me a drink, I thought they meant they'd buy me a drink, and I should drink that drink. And so I drank it. And the owner of the bar didn't like that, and so I didn't last very long before I got fired. I don't even know what time it is. Oh, I got plenty of time. But I don't have that much story, so there you have it. So I moved into this commune kind of place up in Ben Lomond. And I can still remember everybody that lived there. There were a lot of people that lived there. There were 2 gay guys that were from New York City that had moved to Santa Cruz together. One was an attorney and the other one was a taxi cab driver. And they took me under their wing. They wanted me to stop drinking because they thought I was killing myself with alcohol. They'd point out liver spots on my face. I didn't even know what liver spots were. I'm still not sure. But they pointed out all the bad things that was happening to me because of alcohol. And then there was a prostitute that lived there. And she carried a gun, and she had all of her medical tests in the bedroom, and so she was a clean prostitute, and she did most of her work in the valley over there, Silicon Valley, and there was a court reporter from New York City, and there was a guy that was the engineer for the narrow gauge railroad in Felton, and he also took me under his wing and was really trying to save me, and I wasn't savable. at that point. I really wasn't savable. And I ended, you know, but I was having fun. I was having a lot of fun. We would go up to the Bay Area, up to San Francisco for concerts, and I would, free concerts in the park, and I would get really drunk and find myself waking up, passed out next to the women's bathrooms and people walking over me. So, you know, I was not, I wasn't a very good drunk. I got a job at a little restaurant called Goof's, and they opened at 11 o'clock at night, and they were just for the bar crowd. They went from like 11 to 3 or 4. And so I worked there, and I hated it, really, because I didn't feel like I fit in, and I drank all the time. And eventually I got a DUI, the only DUI that I ever had. And I remember I was in a complete blackout. I was heading up Highway 9, and I was in a complete blackout, and I came to, and there were all these sirens and lights around me, and they were asking me to do really stupid things, like touch my nose and count the say the alphabet backwards, and I mean, just all these ridiculous things. And at first I thought it was really funny, and then I realized that this was probably serious. And they took me to jail. And so I got to spend the night in the Santa Cruz Women's Jail. The policeman was pretty nice. He brought me cigarettes. And I stayed there the next day. And that was right about the time that the Patty Hearst thing was going on. And so they thought that I was part of that gang. And so they wouldn't let me go on my own recognizance until my fingerprints came back. I know, huh? Like, I don't know who they thought I was, but they thought I was somebody in that. So anyway, I'm really grateful that I didn't hurt anyone, because that night I was on a mission to get even with a guy that had beat me up the week before. And I was not behaving very well that night. I'm lucky that all I got put in jail for was a DUI, because I tried to pour Coke into his gas tank, Coca-Cola, and, you know, I mean, I was just like, anyway, but getting the DUI didn't even make me think about stopping drinking at all. So in 1976, I moved to SoCal, and I met the father of both my kids. I have two kids, a boy and a girl. And he was from West Virginia by way of Hilton Head Island, North Carolina, or South Carolina. South Carolina, yeah. And he lived in his van, and he used food stamps to eat. And he had moved to California because he heard that he could get free dental care in California. And so it was a great, great, perfect match for me. He didn't drink. He didn't use drugs. And I thought he would save me. And we eventually got married we moved to Santa Cruz because he didn't like the company I was keeping we moved to San Luis Obispo because he didn't like the company I was keeping in Santa Cruz. So we moved to San Luis Obispo. I was pregnant by then. We got married in front of a blind judge in San Luis Obispo at the judge's house. His daughter was the witness. I mean, it was not a formal wedding, and we stayed married about 3 years, and it turned out that he also was an abusive guy. He liked to hit me and kick me when I made him mad, and he was mad a lot, and so I was bruised a lot, and the weird part of that is that he left me. I didn't leave him. He left me, and so I was living in Oceano then. I rented a house in Oceano. I had my two kids, and he pretty much disappeared for a while, their dad did. And I lived next to a meth addict that had a gun that ran around the neighborhood at night, and all the neighbors that would call each other and say, "Watch out. His name was Leonard." Leonard was running. Leonard's out again, you know. And, I mean, it was really, really pretty scary because we were kind of held captive in our houses by this guy. And so my life was a mess. God knew it was a mess, and I knew it was a mess. And I was looking for help,
And I didn't know anything at all about Alcoholics Anonymous or any 12-step programs. I didn't know anything about any of that stuff. But I knew about church. And so I started going to church, and I tried, you know, the New Age metaphysical kind of churches, and I started writing affirmations. I am free of alcohol. I am free of drugs. I am free of cigarettes. And I wrote that for pages and pages and pages. And I also tried Bible studies where they talked in tongues. And then I went down to an ashram in Santa Monica and got hit by a peacock feather by Swami Muktananda, who probably doesn't mean a thing to anybody. but I didn't drink that whole week while I was at the ashram, and I didn't do any drugs. So that was kind of a good thing. I mean, it was kind of a good thing. That was the first time in a long time that I had been, you know, clean. And so I came back, and I started going to a meditation group. And there was this little lady in the meditation group, and she was little, like she was like my size. And she was 50, and she stayed 50 until the day she died 2 years ago. And she never aged. And after the meditation, she started telling these really intimate details of her life. And they were the exact same details of my life. And so I really related to her. And I stopped and got my two tall cans of Ole, Olympia beer. That's what I drank by then. And drank those. And then, but her story kept on playing in my head. And so the next day I called her. And she started talking to me about the third, fourth, and ninth step when I asked her how she could tell that horrible story in public. And the fourth, fifth, and ninth step, which did not make me want what she had, because I did not want to tell anybody all the things I had done wrong, and I didn't want to make amends to anybody. I just wanted to keep real low profile. And she had kept on inviting me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wouldn't go. I count my sobriety date as January 13th of 1981, but I didn't go to my first meeting until May 10th of 1981. And the reason that I went to that meeting that day was because I had lived for 4 months without any drugs or alcohol. I had no skills for living at all. And, I mean, I really had no skills for living. So I had my head in the oven on Mother's Day that day. And the kid's dad came over to the house, and he looked at me, and he went, "Promises, promises, promises." And took the kids and left me. And I called Dorothy, and her husband answered. And Dorothy and her husband had both, he was a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and she was a therapist at Hazelton in Monterey. And so they had taken me under their wing earlier, and that when I quit drinking, she had told me that she would give free lifestyle counseling to me. And so I went to her house, and she told me to quit drinking for a year. And after I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I could never figure out why she said a year. But it's in the book, and I think it's on page 39. And I wrote it down somewhere because I did think about all this stuff. And the quote is, "As we look back, we feel we had gone on drinking many years beyond the point where we could quit on our own willpower. If anyone questions whether he has entered this dangerous area, let him try leaving liquor alone for 1 year." And so she had suggested that I leave liquor alone for 1 year. Do you think I made it for a year? No. I made it 1 week. And I was really proud of that week. But I was also totally defeated because I couldn't go for more than a week. So she welcomed me into the program, started giving me grapevines, telling me about meetings, and that's when I stopped drinking for good. It was January 13th of 1981. And she actually told me later that when she told her story, she had nothing to do with me. She thought I was a good Catholic girl. There was another woman that was in that meditation group that she knew was a drunk, and she was telling her story for that woman. So she always called me the drunk under the bed because I'm the one that showed up and ended up getting sober. So
at 32, I finally got sober. I learned the first step by not drinking for 4 months. I learned that I was powerless over alcohol, but my life was unmanageable with or without alcohol on my own. My life was totally unmanageable. And so I started going to meetings. I went to my first meeting May 10th. Oh, that means my time's up. But I'll finish this. So I went to my first meeting on May 10th, and I loved it. I loved it because they talked about God, they talked about alcohol, and they said the F word all at the same time. And it fit so well into the way that I, into what my head was like. And so gradually, with a loving sponsor and loving friends and going to lots of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, I started to become more authentic over time. And I've learned so much from working the steps with sponsors. I actually have more to say here. It's probably boring, but I've learned so much. I learned so much. So what happened was that I got sober. I was sober about 10 years. My life was really good, and I started wanting to know more about the 11th step. So I found out about a meditation center up in Northern California called Spirit Rock Meditation Center. And I started going every summer. I was a school teacher by then. I'd gotten a full-time job teaching. Started going every summer for 10-day silent meditation retreats. And I loved it. Then my parents started getting sick, and I couldn't do that anymore. But I also went to AA meditation retreats for weekends with Sister B and Father Tom. And he's going to be speaking here pretty soon, and he's really good. If you haven't heard him, he's worth it. And so I started doing that a lot. Now I'm retired, and so I go to even more retreats. I go to week-long retreats in places like Malibu and Santa Cruz and Santa Barbara, and they're AA. They're 12-step retreats, and they really are, they're amazing, and I'm so blessed that I get to do that, that I get to go do that. And I got sick in... I retired in 2010. In January of 2011, I got really sick. I had a bad back. I had back issues, and local doctors wanted to do surgery, and I didn't want surgery. So I went to Stanford, and they told me that, you know, surgery would not work. But so anyway, I worked the steps. I prayed. I worked with my new sponsor, who made me do all kinds of things, and I got better from that, pretty much better from my back thing. And then my last grandson was born in April of 2013, and then I was there when she went into labor, and my son was drunk, because my son's one of us, but he's not even anywhere near recovery. And so I ended up taking her to the hospital. She was bleeding. The baby was born under stress. The baby ended up in the NICU, and I started becoming super grandma. And so I started going there every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks to take care of the rest of the family. And I ended up with autoimmune diseases that kicked in to the place where I couldn't go to meetings anymore. I couldn't do anything anymore. Janet and Tina have both been to my house helping me get out of bed when I was that sick. I just was really, really sick. So I did that for a while. I did all kinds of heavy-duty medications, and my life was wasn't wonderful anymore. And I had a therapist tell me to surround myself with people that loved me and people that I loved. And I remember sitting in a 7 a.m. meeting in the village up above Lightning Joe's with the sun shining on me. And I knew that's what I had to get back to. And so I started going back to 7 a.m. meetings. And it was like starting over again. It really was like starting over again. And I'm so grateful that I had that chance. And sister, you know, the first sponsor, whom I loved dearly, she died about 2 years ago, but she had moved to Arizona. And I drove to Arizona to see her. She was the first one that told me about Sister B. She saw her speak in Seattle, and she said at the end of her pitch, she sang, "You are the wind beneath my sails." And
that's what you guys are for me, is the wind beneath my sails. And when I think about that, I'm so grateful for all of you and for being here and for being polite and listening and caring and loving. And thanks to Robert and Kim. And thanks.
Thank you.